Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News at WCAI. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Jim DeRuiter will be calling in from the New Bedford Standard Times, where he's the editorial page editor there. We'll hear from Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Jeff Spillane, a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise, and Nelson Siegelman will call in. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with news that tops the front page this morning. Police are investigating the discovery of a body that was found at Town Neck Beach in Sandwich. And, George, it appears to be some foul play involved here, but they're saying that it looks like the actual crime may have occurred elsewhere.
That's right. District Attorney Michael O'Keefe is telling us that believe this is a secondary crime scene, that the body was dumped there, and that there's a primary crime scene somewhere. They're not sure yet where. The person has not been identified. Sources have told us that it's a male. Just a gruesome scene from what we understand. This is a complicated investigation, as you might imagine. They have to figure out who the person is first and then go from there in order to try and find out who the suspects might be, you know, whether it's something that happened here on Cape Cod, although that already seems to be unlikely, and that it might have happened somewhere off Cape and perhaps even out of state. They don't know at this point. So we'll be obviously following this story very closely over the next few days.
Sure. And the body was in a pretty obvious place, correct?
That's right. It was at Town Neck Beach. In the parking lot, there's some Jersey barriers that are there. Body was inside of some sort of a tarp type thing and dumped on the other side of those Jersey barriers, and was discovered at some point on Wednesday evening by a passerby.
Okay. Let's talk about drones. Cape Cod has been selected as a place to test drones. And right now, so that testing is currently happening above the base, but it will be expanding.
That's right. This is actually even before they got the permission from the FAA. The military was out there doing some testing of drones, and we've done some coverage on that. This is a civilian operation, though, where they're testing. They're one of six testing sites across the country, looking to see how drones can be integrated with other aircraft in the airspace. And so right now, everything's happening over the base. As you know, that's a restricted airspace, so they don't have to worry about having private aircraft interfering with what they're testing out there. But eventually, we were told in the next 3 to 5 years that this is going to move off base, you know, because they have to, again, test to see how it can be integrated with other aircraft.
And Cape Cod also offers the opportunity to test how well the materials will hold up of the drone to the elements around here, the seawater and the...
Absolutely. There's so many variables here in the Northeast, and that's why this site, it's a co-site with New York. And what they really liked about this site is here on Cape Cod, as you said, you have the elements, you have the ocean, all of those factors. And in the part of New York where they are, which is in, I believe it's in the Rochester area, if I'm not mistaken, they have the mountains and, the weather variables there, very, very cold winters, snow.
Sure.
So, it's pretty interesting. This is another one of those things that we'll be watching. And this came out of there's a task force statewide that's looking at how the military installations here in Massachusetts can remain viable. And this is one of the things that they're pointing to for Joint Base Cape Cod.
Yeah, keep the jobs. Over the years, the past several years, we've talked about, several turbine, land-based turbine proposals, but one in particular in Dennis at the location where the Aquacultural Resource Corporation is, and that's the place where they grow all the seed for shellfishing, and they've been trying to get a wind turbine, but so far they haven't had any luck, but we hear there's news on that.
That's right. Once again, with these wind turbine projects, there's a lot of legal wrangling over them. And in this case, there's been another appeal. This has been an ongoing thing. Initially, it was approved by a local historic committee, and then the Historic District Commission, which is sort of this regional, Old Kings Highway, it's this regional agency, stepped in and said, oh, you showed poor judgment in giving this approval of this particular wind turbine. And so it's a back and forth process. And in that process, the people, this particular business, this shellfishing business, which thought they were going to put in a wind turbine to help offset the energy costs that it takes to run this facility, has ended up spending a lot of money in legal costs.
Yeah.
Trying to get a go of it. So,
and they've talked about how really important this turbine is to their business, and it's a crucial business to this area because all the shell fishermen look to it, essentially most of them, I would imagine, look to it for their seed. So if ARC goes away, that's a problem.
That's right. And, it's amazing to me, the appeals process seems to be endless. They can win over and over again, and there have been three appeals so far, and this looks like it's going to be a fourth.
What are the issues? The concerns are being raised by neighbors who are concerned that if this turbine goes up, what, they'll have a situation like in Falmouth where there are a couple turbines which people living near them say are causing health problems.
That's right.
Some people living near them say it's causing health
problems. Right. The flicker, the sound from them. But last week, the appellate division of the district court said that one of the people who's raising this as a visual abut, a quote unquote visual abutter, really doesn't have any standing.
Oh.
In the case. So but the issues are the same as they are. Or they have been in other places like Falmouth and off Cape, mm-hmm. the flicker and the noise and the potential issues that result from that.
Right. Let's talk about fishing. Some of the local fishermen were pretty upset when they heard about a fishing trawler out, and there's a debate whether the fishing trawlers were out in federal waters or whether they strayed into state waters, but the concern is that they were scooping up lots of herring.
Yeah, they were catching fish like you would like to catch fish if you're one of us who goes out on the weekend and throws your line in the water, but for other fishermen this is a real issue because what they were taking, the herring, is an important food source for other fisheries that are out there, and that's the real concern among the fishermen is what impact these trawlers going out there and taking as much fish as they did will have, what impact that will have on the other things that they're attempting to catch out there. As you said, there was concern about whether they were actually, this is allowed in federal waters, but were they actually crossing the line into state waters as they were doing this?
And where was this?
I guess it's in an area out off of Chatham, and the management area runs from Chatham to Gloucester, and it's about 200 miles out. Off the Outer Cape.
Yeah, I see. And these midwater trawlers have been controversial because there's a lot of bycatch, so they're not just catching the particular species that they want to catch. The way that these things work, they scoop up a lot of stuff, and what they're not supposed to get goes back into the ocean, oftentimes dead.
Absolutely, and the other issue is, yeah, how do you police this?
Right.
It's easier, I guess, for law enforcement to see it from the air, but you know, how much is that possible? Officials were saying that it's driving away some of the whales that are so important to our economy because of whale watches and things like that. So there, it's the offshoot effect as much as that people are concerned about, as much as they're also concerned about how much herring have been taken.
Right. Is it clear in this story that something illegal was happening, or is there confusion about whether this was actually allowed in those federal waters?
Yeah, I think it's debatable.
Right.
Both sides are saying, we definitely have someone in the story that says, they're doing nothing wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So. That's what I was wondering. So maybe there needs to be a little bit more investigation there. And that was the takeaway I got from that story, that they're going to keep looking into it. I think the quote was, there will be a price to pay. But that might be about the lack of numbers in that of that particular fishery.
That's right.
Going forward.
Yeah. But you could read it two different ways.
Absolutely. Right. Let's talk about this Board of Health story in Orleans. I've been fascinated. I'm always interested when town leaders start to bicker with each other. And this got a little nasty. So there was a new person elected to the Board of Health in Orleans, and he wasn't exactly greeted with open arms.
That's right. When town leaders go bad. Coming up next.
They attack, yeah.
A newly elected board member at his first meeting, and there was some it was a Board of Health, who would have thought, and there's some contention at the outset. Are you going to recuse yourself? This particular board member, David Currier, he was asked, are you going to recuse yourself? And he said, look, I run a bowling alley, not a restaurant.
So they were going to have a discussion about a particular restaurant, and they looked to the new member and said, you're going to recuse yourself.
Right.
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 Bowling alley restaurant. Okay.
Right. So ultimately, he does recuse himself. He leaves the room.
And they tell him to leave the room.
They tell him to leave the room.
Which I don't know why they're doing. Isn't it a public meeting? Okay.
And he's an elected official.
Yeah. Okay.
Ultimately, answers to the voters, not his fellow board members. But he leaves, and apparently caught on tape is one of them leaning over to another board member, and these two particular board members are named in the story, Job Taylor III and Augusta McCusick. And one says to the other, can you believe that? And I'm not going to say it on the radio. I'm
they
not
call
sure
them
if I can
a bad word. Yeah. Okay.
Not sure if I can say that.
No, you can't.
Okay, thank you. And so, a lot of people get outraged by that.
Because it was broadcast over TV. They're watching them badmouth the new member.
Right, right. So there's an uproar, and this week it came to a head. People showing up at the Board of Health meeting, and they showed up at a selectman's meeting demanding for the resignation of these two Board of Health members who said, no, we won't go. The selectman voted, I believe it was 4-0, encourage these two Board of Health members to resign because of their behavior. And they were insisting they weren't going to do it, but late breaking yesterday afternoon, one of them did. McCusick resigned, according to an email that was sent out by the assistant town administrator in Orleans to other town officials. He resigned. We're not sure. We're not sure of the details of that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he felt the public pressure and decided to resign. But you can only imagine that there were a lot of people who showed up at these meetings. As many as 50 Orleans residents and business leaders showed up and said, this is outrageous and something needs to be done about it.
Drama. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Joshua Balling's going to join us. He's with the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and one of the stories we're going to talk about is how the island is having a real trouble holding on to police officers. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Joshua Balling, the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Hello, Josh.
Good Good morning.
Good morning to you. So the Conservation Commission denied an erosion control project that people have been paying close attention to. Where is it, and what's going on with that?
It is out on the east end of the island, below Baxter Road on the Sconset Bluff. The CONCOM voted 4-2 on Tuesday afternoon to deny that project. It's already actually installed. It was installed under an emergency permit back in the winter to protect the bluff from the ravages of winter storms. And the process has been ongoing for about 7 months of public hearings. And the CONCOM voted 4-2 again on Tuesday, ruling that the structure installed by the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund and the town of Nantucket would have some adverse impacts, likely, on the surrounding areas. They ruled that there might be other alternatives that were less costly environmentally to the area, and voted that they probably should remove it pending an appeal. Obviously, the applicants, the co-applicants, the town and the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund can appeal to the State Department of Environmental Protection. They've already vowed to do that. If that doesn't happen, however, the geotextile tubes that make up the project will have to be removed. The project's cost about $2 million, paid for completely by about 15 to 20 homeowners on Baxter Road, and about a third of the maintenance on it has been done so far at another cost of about $250,000, so it's quite a costly project. It's been funded completely by private property owners in the area, and this is an ongoing debate that's been happening for years out on the island's east end about erosion control and the impacts on the surrounding properties out there.
And briefly remind us what the erosion situation is out there right now.
The erosion situation out there this season hasn't been too bad, but last year erosion ravaged the east end of the island. A home had to be removed after it came too close to the bluff. It was in danger of toppling perhaps 80 feet onto the beach below. Baxter Road itself is in potential danger of having to be removed or having to be vacated due to how close it's coming to the edge of the bluff if erosion isn't somehow stopped, or if things don't change out there. The town is considering options to move the road. A number of houses have already been moved out there, and this is some of the highest-priced real estate on the island. There are some homes out there, beautiful summer homes that have been there for generations. Some of them have already been moved. Some of them are very close to the edge.
Right. Let's talk about the police officer situation that you have the story in the paper this week about. So the island continues to lose officers to the mainlands, and that's what? Cost of living? Housing? What is the situation there?
You hit the nail on the head. It's both of those. Out here on Nantucket, private and public businesses, the public sector, always have a problem retaining quality employees, but the police department has a particular problem, and it's a costly one because it has to invest so much in its officers and training and equipment, and then it's a particular problem when they leave after 3 years or less. You know, like we said, departments across the island sometimes have trouble retaining experienced professionals due to mostly the high cost of living out here, due to transportation and the island's reputation as an affluent vacation spot and affordable housing options. We're a finite space out here. Housing comes at a premium, but most of those departments don't spend like the police department does. It has to send the recruits to the academy for 6 months, then train them for several months, and all while paying them a salary of around $50,000 a year out here on Nantucket, and another $10,000 or $12,000 to equip them. And two officers are leaving this weekend for jobs on the mainland. A number of officers have already left this year. Over the past 4 years, 18 officers have resigned, and one's retired, most to take jobs elsewhere. And seven this year alone have left. So it's a particularly vexing problem for the police department, the town in general, and the police chief is hoping that some perhaps creative or strategic solutions can be developed to attract and retain some quality officers out here.
So there's no plan yet. He wants to brainstorm a plan?
Sounds good. We could certainly use the help. You know, obviously, when you lose that many officers, particularly going into the summertime, we have a very strong and efficient and qualified police force out here. But with the summer coming, the fewer officers you have, the more difficult it is to keep staffing levels where they should be. And the police chief says he needs those officers. He's funded for those officers. It's just the problem of getting them here and then keeping them here.
And you said a salary of about $50,000, that's the average or the median?
That's the starting salary.
That's the starting salary. That's not very high on Nantucket.
Not very high on Nantucket. Not most people would say probably not bad for a starting salary. And there's also the option usually of quite a bit of overtime for the police officers, detail work, that kind of thing.
Right.
But even that's not enough out here.
Yeah, I understand. All right. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. The paper also has a story about Wendy Schmidt's wooden sailboat catching fire and sinking at sea. Of course, she's the, in addition to being a businesswoman, a philanthropist, she's also the wife of Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google. So go to the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror if you'd like to learn more about that story. You can also follow Josh on Twitter, @JBallingIM. Thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Jim DeRuta. He's the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about the town of Dartmouth. And this is a really fast-growing community there. And they have, like many of the communities around here, a town meeting system of government. So people come together and make decisions about spending and new bylaws in a town meeting situation. But they want to change that?
Well, some people want to and some people don't. Hmm. Their town meeting, Dartmouth's town meeting, the members are all elected. And about half of them showed up at the town meeting this week and voted down the charter change. Dartmouth's about 34,000 people. It used to be a farming community, a lot of dairies, right in the area where if you drive into Dartmouth on Route 6 now, you'd see the mall, Ann and Hope. That whole area was dairies, but now from the New Bedford line straight to the Westport line, it's all commercial. And it's grown so fast that a lot of folks think that they need to change the town, the form of government. So there was talk of maybe having a city council form with a mayor and just getting rid of the town meeting.
Hmm.
In two votes over the past two Aprils, about 14% voter turnout came out and said, yeah, let's do that. Let's consider a charter change. And in two times after that at town meeting, the elected members came out and said, no, we're going to keep it just the way it is.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting. You got to go to the town meeting members in order to get rid of town meeting. They're elected. You can see that might be a hard vote for them to take. Interesting, they might go to they're considering going to a city council model. Wouldn't it make sense to, if you're starting at a town meeting situation, to go to a board of selectmen model with a town manager?
Well, they have a board of selectmen, and that was what the charter change, part of what the charter change was going to accomplish, was it was going to take all of the town departments and put them all under the authority of the select board. Right now, other boards in town are chosen by department heads are chosen by a department board and the select board together.
Oh.
And that bothers the other departments. The department heads like the way things are run now, and the select board thinks that perhaps it would be a little more efficient. For instance, there were about three different departments in control of mowing around the town, whether it was for parks or other town buildings or cemeteries, and they made a small change to that a year ago so that would be a little more efficient.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll continue to pay attention to what Dartmouth decides. Let's talk about a Bristol Community College student who's been arrested for hacking. It sounds like something out of the 80s movie War Games here, except it gets a little bit more serious.
Yeah, this fellow, about 25 years old, attended BCC three times, three different semesters since about 2008. And the last time he was there in 2013, he apparently got login credentials from three of his professors and changed some of his grades, changed a couple of his fellow classmates' grades, offered a couple other classmates the opportunity to have their grades changed. He did this about seven times, but what happened once the U.S. attorney started to investigate is they found that not only that had he changed some grades, but he'd been in a local police department's computer system and stolen some emails from the chief. They didn't say what department it was. But then they found that he'd been in law enforcement computer systems around the country and that he was in possession of about 14,000 stolen credit card, debit card, and payment card numbers.
Hmm. And he's agreed to plead guilty to these charges?
He has, and if the state accepts, the government accepts his plea, he faces 4 years in prison and 3 years of supervised release.
Okay, and let's update our listeners on Old Rochester Regional School District School Committee, and they had been trying to decide what to do about Good Friday, whether to have classes on Good Friday or not have classes on Good Friday. What's happening there?
They had decided, the school committee and the teachers union had decided that they were going to hold classes on Good Friday, and a woman who was opposed to that, put together a petition and got 700 signatures. And they brought it before the committee again on Monday. And on 5-3 votes from the union and the school committee, they decided to keep school on Good Friday. They're not going to close it down. Well, some people really are really not too happy with it, calling it a real slap in the face to the community and to the citizens who've come out and showed that this is where they stand on it.
Right.
An insult to the community.
Okay. Understood. Thank you, Jim DeRuda. Jim DeRuda is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. And you can follow him, you can follow the editorial page on Twitter at OpinionSCT. The SCT is for South Coast Today. And of course, South Coast Today is the website. Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
You're welcome. Sally Rose joins us, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Sean.
We've talked about some of the shellfishing opportunities out in Provincetown area, Truro, Wellfleet area, and now it looks like there's a development area being created right there. It's finally getting started?
That's right. And this is at the 50-acre, what's called an aquaculture development area, and it straddles the border about a mile offshore of the two towns, Provincetown and Truro. And yes, it is now open for shellfishing, so that's exciting. It's 25 of those acres are for Truro, 25 for Provincetown. And the town started, as you said, the process several years back. And then last year, the State Division of Marine Fisheries put a hold on that project because the floating cages that they're planning to use in that deep water area, it's a deep water aquaculture project, they were concerned because they're tethered by rope to the seabed. So they're concerned that they would pose a threat to sea turtles and whales. So the towns and state reached a compromise, restricting the strength and the volume of the gear, and that they stipulated that there's to be no activity between January 1st and May 15th, when the right whales might be feeding in the area. So now the state has given the green light for what they're now considering a pilot program. And John Santos, former Provincetown selectman, he is the first grant recipient to start work out there. He began installing cages with oyster seed on his 2-acre grant on May 16th. And so far, he's got about 20 cages out there. And at least 3 others in Provincetown and 5 in Truro have been cleared to begin installing cages, but none have started so far. So it'll take Santos and the others about 18 months, we're told, to grow the shellfish to maturity. And according to the shellfish constable, who works for both towns, because they're growing them in the subtidal waters so that they remain in the water all the time, they'll be seen as a superior product. So we'll keep our fingers crossed about that.
Yeah, shellfishing is a real bright spot when it comes to fishing here on the Cape and the islands. So that's great. Quickly, tell us about this exhibition of old postcards in Truro. If people are interested in Truro history, and history certainly goes back a long way there.
Yeah, it does. It's a very nice, very cool exhibition. It's called Summer Days of Long Ago, Old Truro Through Vintage Picture Postcards. So the title really tells it all. It's opening with a reception from 1 to 4:30 this Sunday, June 8th, at the Truro Historical Museum. And during the reception, the admission will be free. And it's the old postcards, sort of lithography illustrations, and in addition, the messages from those residents and visitors home to their families and friends. So you really get a sense of what summertime life was like back in Truro back then. It was mainly focused on the first decade or two of the 1900s. So.
And how long does this last?
Well,
we can look it up.
I can't remember how long the exhibition will be hanging.
And that's at the Truro Historical Society.
Exactly.
Thank you, Sally Rose. Sally is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. And on the phone, Jeff Spillane, a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Tell us, a school committee member was visiting the Quashnet School. That's one of the elementary schools in the town. It is one of the elementary schools in town of Mashpee. And what happened?
It is, and this is a developing story, Sean. We should have some more information on this today. One of the school committee members, Phyllis Sprout, was volunteering in a third grade class last Wednesday, and in an interview with the Enterprise this week, she described herself as having a meltdown in front of the children. She became angry at the kids, she said, and there's some question as to whether or not she had made contact with two of the children. One of which she said that she touched to get this little girl to breathe, and then there's a question of whether or not she slammed a book and hit another child. So the police are investigating that now and deciding whether or not it would constitute an assault and battery. But the interesting thing here is Ms. Sprout, when she spoke with us, said that she was not in a good place that day and really blamed her anger on being dehydrated from working on her farm that day. So there is some question there as to what could happen, what the outcome could be. And there is some speculation that it could result in a resignation.
Was she regretful?
She was. She said that she was sorry that it happened, and also that she sent an apology to the students and stated that she would never volunteer at the school again.
Any more or anything else about what prompted it? Were the kids unruly or anything?
No, we don't have a lot of information as to what happened there in the classroom. It appears that she may have been reading to the children.
Oh, okay.
So we expect more details to come out of the investigation fairly soon.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. That's great. Well done reporting there. Tell us also, there's a proposal on the table by the newest selectman in town and regarding taxes. What's that?
That's right. Andrew Gottlieb, who was recently elected to the Board of Selectmen, and his election was confirmed this week, by the way, on a recount, is really hitting the ground running. And he's already acting on one of his campaign promises, which was to investigate the possibility of providing some homeowners in town with some tax relief. And on Monday night, the Board of Selectmen voted unanimously to create a working group to investigate whether or not to implement what's called, on the Massachusetts General Law Books, Title IX, Chapter 59, which would allow the town to give up to a 20% tax break for residential properties that are occupied year-round by the homeowners. Now, on the flip side of that, that 20% would have to be made up by the second homeowners in town. And we'll have an answer on that by the end of July as to whether or not the town will implement this policy.
Would that have to go in front of a town meeting?
There's a question as to not whether or not that would or would have to go in front of the Board of Selectmen just for approval. Still trying to find out what that would entail, but that's part of what the working group will present. And one of the interesting things here, if they come back by the end of July with a decision that they are going to do this, it could make for a very interesting Board of Selectmen meeting in August, when a lot of those second homeowners will be in town. I'm sure it will be out in full force at town hall.
Okay. Jess Blaine is a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. He joined us by phone today, and we appreciate it very much. Also a story in the paper this week about the Mashpee Dog Park. A design firm has been selected for that, and the park should be open by year's end. And a whole selection of stories in the Mashpee Enterprise. Jeff Blaine, you can follow him on Twitter, at Jeff Spillane. Okay, that's easy enough. Thank you very much, Jeff. We'll talk to you later.
All right, Sean.
Okay, bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, of course, George Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times, and we expect also to hear from Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, welcome back, and this is The Point on WCAI, and joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. So the Martha's Vineyard Times has had a series of stories related to the opiate and heroin epidemic that Cape Cod and the islands have experienced. And this week you're talking about Section 35 commitments. Tell us about that. What is a Section 35 commitment?
Well, yes, this is the fifth in a series that reporter Barry Stringfellow has done. And it's very interesting. Of course, there are many issues when you live on an island and you have to get to the mainland, and that's particularly true with the Section 35 commitment. Essentially, it allows a family member or the police to put somebody into a treatment program. There's no choice involved. That person has to go. They can put an addict into involuntary rehab for up to 90 days. So, as Dr. Charles Silberstein says, it's Section 35 is the last resort. He's the resident psychiatrist and addiction specialist at the Vineyard Hospital. The problem comes up is that in order to commit someone, they have to be brought to Falmouth, where a certified doctor can confirm that they, in fact, should be put into a treatment program. And all of this, there are a lot of moving parts involved. Basically, first you have to have a judge agree, then you have to have a doctor agree, and all of that has to happen on the mainland, but it begins here. So this story describes some of the frustration family members and police encounter when they're trying to deal with someone, because all of it has to happen in one day as well. It's not easy, and it's a problem, and for family members on the Vineyard, it can be very frustrating and a source of great anguish.
Sure. Interesting statistic in that story, 67% increase in the number of Section 35 commitments since 2006. So as this epidemic has continued to roll on, the Section 35s have gone up. And as it's, I encourage people, anyone who is dealing with an addiction issue in their family, to go and read the story, because obviously one of the problems is family members are hesitant to make this commitment because they feel they're abandoning their loved one. But, I mean, you reach a certain point with this addiction, and you have little choice.
Well, sure, and that's why the story describes it as the choice of last resort. Let's face it, it's no easy answer, and even when the person gets out, there's no guarantee that they're going to be any better off. So it's right. There's a great deal of desperation involved in it on all sides, I'm sure.
Yeah. Also, the paper this week, the Martha's Vineyard Times, on the editorial page, has a write-up about two veterans of D-Day.
I really enjoyed getting the opportunity to talk to these two men. I've talked to them before, Fred Ted Morgan and Nelson Bryant. They're both just such wonderful people, and you have a conversation with them. They're always quite modest. They talk about the experience of landing in Normandy on D-Day, and you can't help but just be impressed by what they experienced, what they have to say, and just the way they say it. Fred Ted Morgan was a longtime Edgartown selectman, highly respected. He was a medic, and he just saw the worst of the worst. And today he's down at the museum, in the World War II Museum down in Louisiana.
Oh.
And he just, you know, he's just such a interesting person. He talks about trying to save people, and obviously couldn't save them all. And Nelson Bryant, who was a longtime outdoor writer for the New York Times, he just gives a compelling description of watching tracer bullets coming up as he was dropping in by parachute. Both of the men, by the way, were parachuted into Normandy, and Nelson Bryant was shot. He was left wounded and just barely escaped capture. And I asked him, there was something very, very telling. I asked him about what the whole thing, whole experience meant to him. And he said that for once in his life, he knew that he measured up as a man, he said. And of these, we owe such a great debt to these men, and we should remember that certainly on this day.
Absolutely. Heroes. True. Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. You can go read those stories there, as well as the entire selection of stories at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson Siegelman.
Thank you.
Okay. And George Brennan, a reporter with the Cape Cod Times, is in our Woods Hole studio right now with a list of stories that the Cape Cod Times has produced this week, including one about evading zoning for marijuana. Some towns have moved to create special little zones in town where marijuana dispensaries could go, assumably medicinal marijuana dispensaries at this point. Others have put that off, and now some are saying maybe we won't do it at all.
That's right. Well, in Harwich, this issue came up at a recent town meeting. They decided not to adopt a zoning bylaw, which several other towns have done. Places, Barnstable, Brewster, Dennis, Falmouth, a number of places have put these into place, which they did it sort of to protect the town. You know,
right.
we want to dictate where these go rather than have them, you know, in places where we don't want them. But there are other towns who have not yet taken any action. At the Sandwich Town meeting, they voted to extend a moratorium through June of 2015. They've since been told that moratorium will go out of effect in December.
Mm.
And so they may bring something back to their town meeting in the fall. You know, there's a debate back and forth. What happens here if you don't have something in place? There are some state guidelines that say, you know, you can't have these within certain distance from a school, for example,
right.
or a community building, those types of things. So there is some protection in place, even if you don't have one of these bylaws.
Yeah.
But
it reminds me of the late 90s when a lot of communities were trying to decide, okay, where can we put different pornography stores and such, you know, because it had come down to, look, if you don't have a place for these, they can go anywhere they want.
That's right. In this particular case, I mean, you know, the dispensaries, there are guidelines in what was passed by the state. Is it 35, I think, that are going to be licensed statewide?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not as if they're going to pop up in every community.
That's true.
And Harwich, for example, feels somewhat protected because Dennis zoned for one, and they are in line to get one of the licenses.
Oh, right.
So
it's unlikely.
Is someone going to put one in Harwich?
The state would allow that to even happen. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Joe's Lobster Mart and Joseph Vaudo, who was a town official there, owner of Joe's Lobster Mart in Sandwich. And tell us a little bit about the background here. We've been following this for quite a while now.
Yeah, well, I went up to a hearing in Boston yesterday. The issue here is he pleaded guilty to receiving some stolen oysters. This dates back to last summer when there were thefts going on at oyster beds on Cape Cod. And he pleaded guilty to receiving some of those in his fish market and was punished for that. He was given a fine. The state came in and State Department of Public Health, following that, said, "We're going to revoke your license." They filed a notice of intent. He appealed that, and that's what the hearing was for yesterday. This was just a pre-hearing. It was kind of to set the framework of this case. But we got a little window into what he's going to use as an argument to try to retain his license. And his attorney said, essentially, this would be double jeopardy. He's already been punished for what he did. So taking away his license would be double jeopardy. He's been punished sufficiently. He's been embarrassed. The attorney also tried to make the point of what a crucial part of the local economy he is, being both a wholesaler and a retailer, important for the shellfishermen who need a place to sell their product, and restaurants and retailers who need supply. But interestingly, the magistrate said, "I'm not going to take that kind of thing into account."
Right.
So, you know, in some respects, in sitting there and observing it, it was a message to Vado and his attorney that you may need to come up with something else here, because the arguments that he was making doesn't appear that's going to be taken into consideration by this magistrate when he makes his final decision. Now, the Joe's Lobster Mart remains open as this appeal process goes on, and the full hearing is not scheduled until September.
Will they have witnesses and everything in that hearing?
They will have witnesses. They'll have sworn testimony. He's not allowed to bring in character witnesses, so the witnesses have to be specific to the case. And, you know, the magistrate sits up there and he'll be the judge in this case.
What an interesting story, just because of his role and his connection to the actual fishermen who were being ripped off and have things stolen from them. And then, of course, as you say, the importance of that business, not only to the fishermen, but to – I've been there. I've seen huge lines and people sending lobsters all over the country. It's like for many families, that's one of the places they go. We have many of those businesses here on the Cape. That's like a traditional place to go. But, I mean – This is serious stuff.
He's been in business for 43 years.
Wow.
And he employs 20 people there. I mean, so this, you know, there is a side effect to this. You know, some people are, you know, potentially looking at looking for jobs elsewhere. Right. So we have to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm.
Let's move quickly through the next few stories here. I want to talk about this alcohol suspension for a business just because of the season we're getting into with all the tourists here. And anyone who's driven Route 28 after 9 o'clock at night, know you're taking your life into your hands with some of the ways people drive and obviously intoxication.
That's right. Red Face Jack's Pub was before the Board of Selectmen, which is the licensing authority in Yarmouth. And it was for a violation where one of their bartenders served someone who was already drunk. The patron acknowledged that he had a couple of beers in his car before going in. And then he went into the restaurant and had, depending on what count you believe, 6 or 7 or 7 or 8. And, you know, the bartender testified that he thought the man was fine. He never slurred his speech, acted like a gentleman, didn't believe he was intoxicated. The selectman, you know, took the fact that he then left the restaurant and was stopped. He had a blood alcohol level that was double the legal limit. And so they suspended the license of Red Face Jack's for 2 days. The owner did not contest it. He surrendered his license right away and has already served the suspension.
I don't want to go too far down this road, but do you, in your experience, see consistency in communities holding businesses accountable for over-serving?
You know, I cover the town of Sandwich, and they've really taken a hard line. Anytime someone gets stopped and they identify the restaurant, they bring them before the licensing board. Mm-hmm. I don't see that everywhere.
No, I don't either. Okay, let's talk about another sandwich story that you've covered regarding a field at the high school.
Yeah, this has to be the feel-good story of the week, I have
good.
To tell you.
We need one.
This is the DeConto Stadium in Sandwich, the Captain Gerald F. Jerry DeConto Veterans Memorial Stadium. He was killed in 9/11 at the Pentagon, and the family has been working for years to try and build a stadium at Sandwich High School in his memory. And they've raised money privately. They gave a tremendously generous donation, $250,000 themselves, to get this jump started back in 2006. And they've used community preservation funds. But there was one final piece that the family, from the outset, they said they wanted this field to be a turf field, a synthetic turf field, mm-hmm. because the fields in Sandwich get used so much that the grass fields were getting ruined. And Jerry DeConto himself was a Sandwich High School soccer star. He was the best player on Cape Cod in 1975. And that's where the family's commitment to this comes from. Well, this week, the family learned that Senate President Murray, put the money, $500,000, into the budget, the state budget, for this synthetic field. And it still has to pass conference committee and be signed into law by Governor Deval Patrick. But she's fairly certain that this will remain in the budget. You know, the family was just choked up when they learned that this had been put in the budget. They said, "We're looking for a white knight. We're looking for an angel." And, you know, David DeConto told me this week that Senate President Murray is that. She said she wasn't trying to be any kind of savior, but Jerry DeConto deserves to be remembered.
That is a good feel-good story. Thank you, George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And George joined me in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow George on Twitter at GPB227. And thanks to our other contributors, Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.